It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why Wisconsin was ranked as the third most bike-friendly state in the United States.
First, most of us talk to ourselves from time to time, out loud, quietly, negatively or positively, or even with self-affirmations, like Stuart Smalley.
I'm going to do a terrific show today, and I'm going to help people because I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
He sounds just like you before
me.
Showtime, Rob.
Yeah, that's exactly my self-affirmation.
Eerie.
Doggone it.
Well, our next guest looked into the science behind self-talk like that and found out that it can make a big difference in our lives if we do it right.
Elizabeth Bernstein is with us. She is a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, where she writes the Bonds on Relationships column. Elizabeth, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So what is self-talk?
Self-talk is sort of a subset of thinking, and it's where we address ourselves. We could do it in our heads, not out loud, but some people do it out loud, and we're really talking to ourselves. We are having a conversation, usually walking ourselves through something or trying to motivate ourselves.
It's reassuring to know that there's an actual term for it, even though most of us do it, we don't usually admit to doing it. When do people usually use self-talk?
Well, it's several different ways. Lots of times people use it to psych themselves up. So, you know, if it's for a task, you know, yes, I'm going to have a good show because I'm good enough, I'm smart enough. But it can also be, that's called motivational self-talk, when people use it to psych themselves up for a task or a competition, something like that. There's also something called instructional self-talk, and that's where we're practicing something. We're walking ourselves through something. Could be when we're driving. You can say, now, turn left at the next light, or people who are learning a sport or sort of training for something will talk to themselves about it. And the goal is that it'll eventually become sort of something that we do by rote. But we need to talk ourselves through it quite a few times to begin with to get it there.
Okay, Rob, now ask Elizabeth a good question. How can we be effective? You actually looked into the science behind self-talk, and there are right ways and wrong ways to do it. What are some of the good ways to do it?
So the good ways to do it, this is interesting. You're supposed to talk to yourself as you would talk to someone else. So researchers who have looked at this say you, instead of saying, I need to do this, I need to do that, somehow that comes across more as scolding. You talk to yourself with the word you, with the pronoun you. You know, you need to ask a good question. You need to have a good answer to this question. Or you also use your name. So, hey, Rob, you know, you need to pay more attention. You need to use your name. You're distancing yourself a little bit, and somehow it makes the researchers say it makes you pay more attention to what you're saying.
What's the deal with that? Why would saying you instead of I make that kind of difference?
The researchers feel that it gives you sort of objective, helpful feedback, that it allows you to distance yourself from that critical voice that's in your head, and you somehow are kinder to yourself, and you're giving yourself a little bit more objective talk than you would unnecessarily if you were, you know, just saying I. Somehow that I allows us just to say every mean thing we want to say to ourselves.
So is it like you become your own coach when you talk like that, as though there is literally, you know, well, figuratively, literally, someone standing beside you and coaching you, if you use that language, that almost is what happens.
Exactly. When other people use your name, hey, Elizabeth, you need to do this, you know, they're usually kind, and they're usually, you know, boosting you up. Coaches try to, you know, get you, motivate you in positive ways. And so that's what you're really doing. Exactly. You're being your own coach.
And is negative self-talk bad for us? Does it hurt our performance or our self-image or something?
Well, it's interesting. So you don't want to beat yourself up. Nobody wants to beat yourself up at all. But a little negative self-talk is not bad. It's the way you deliver it to yourself. So instead of saying, hey, you know, I just bombed that presentation at work, you know, what you need to say is, okay, Elizabeth, that wasn't your best effort. You know, next time you need to buckle down, do more prep. You know, you need to sort of deliver the bad news gently to yourself, and then that sort of pep talk.
So you're not being a bully with yourself. You're not going, oh, you blew it. You're so stupid. Why did you do that? You're kind of kind, but you're still tough.
Exactly. You would never tell a friend, like, you know, hopefully you wouldn't. You blew it. You're an idiot. You know, what a moron. I can't believe you did this. You would say, like, hey, okay, you know, I thought that was good, but, you know, it wasn't the best, and you need to do a little better next time. How can you do better? Well, you better prepare. So you really want to talk to yourself as you would talk to a good friend you really cared about.
Our producer, Amanda Magnus, says she uses self-talk when she's learning new roller derby stuff. I tried it when I was learning how to downhill ski, and I survived, you know, talking through each step. That's more on the instructional than the motivational side. Is there a right way to do that kind of instructional self-talk when we're learning something new?
You're supposed to be very short. The directions you give yourself are supposed to be short, precise, and consistent. And so that consistent is very important, that if you're learning a new task, you're learning roller derby, or I actually am a scuba diver, and this past weekend I went diving, and I did talk myself through it. Okay, now you need to do this, now you need to do that. But you need to, the key with the consistency is that you're hoping eventually that this behavior that you're talking yourself through, these new skills that you're learning, you will be able to, you know, get them to the point where you don't have to talk about it. You can just do it. So to do that, you need to be consistent over and over until, you know, your mind and body sort of just take over and do it automatically.
Elizabeth, does everybody use self-talk, or, you know, if they say they don't, are they really doing it and they're just not admitting it?
Exactly. So the research shows that everybody talks to themselves. The people who say they don't are either they don't know it or they're lying. So
that's kind of reassuring.
You may not realize it, but I'm sorry?
It's kind of reassuring because I've done it in the past. Usually I do it when I'm working out or something and things are getting difficult. But I always think maybe I should stop because maybe this is a little unhealthy. But is it healthy overall?
It's very, very healthy to do it, to do it well. You don't want to beat yourself up again. You can't keep telling yourself a moron, you're a moron, and you can't, you can't look in the mirror and say, oh, you ugly idiot. You have to really talk to yourself very kindly again, as if you were, a good friend, talking to a good friend. But it's very important. I mean, top world-class athletes do this. This is how they walk them through the task, themselves through tasks. They will walk themselves through a performance before it happens, or a competition. I mean, this is very successful people use self-talk to great success. So it's definitely a good thing. It's just all in the way you do it.
It seems like the overarching message here is to practice conscious self-talk, because I'll kind of have self-rambling, I guess I can call it, neither positive nor negative, like, it'd be nice to go back to bed now or something, and first thing in the morning, just rambling self-talk as I'm rambling this question out now. So being conscious sounds like the key here.
Being very conscious of what you tell yourself. And again, exactly that. You would bore a friend if you just ran through your morning. Now you're going to brush your teeth. Now you're going to make some coffee. So, very conscious. Again, talking to yourself as if you were a really good friend and with real kindness. I think the problem is many of us probably talk to ourselves way too harshly. So again, the negative self-talk can be helpful, but you need to say, like, okay, wasn't a great job, but hey, I know you can do it better. Here's how you can do it better. Again, just coach yourself as if you were your own best coach.
And you mentioned someone close to you in your life being a foremost practitioner of this. I think it was your dad was a big self-talker.
Loves to self-talk, yes. So you can talk. He says that, no one else listens to him. So he will have to talk to himself. So, big thing. I once was walking down the street in Manhattan and turned a corner and only realized I was in deep in conversation with myself when a colleague who happened to be sitting on a bench just burst out laughing when he saw me. So then I realized, oh, well, I'd been talking. So I think we all do it. And the key my dad did teach us, give yourself a high five. Tell yourself, he taught his kids, give yourself a high five and tell yourself how great you are. And that can be really helpful when you do something well.
Elizabeth, thank you so much, as always, for being with us.
Thanks for being with me.
That's Elizabeth Bernstein, columnist for The Wall Street Journal. She writes the Bonds on Relationships column. The League of American Bicyclists just ranked Wisconsin as the third most bike-friendly state in the U.S. Dave Schlabowski is with us now to talk about what makes Wisconsin a good place for biking and what might make it better. He's the deputy director of the Wisconsin Bike Fed. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the League of American Bicyclists, as we said, put Wisconsin number 3 on their list of bike-friendly states, up from 8th place last year. Are we getting better over time at making our state bike-friendly?
It's a complicated question. We've been as high as 2nd. We've fallen. We've kind of, over the last handful of times we've been ranked, we've been in kind of like a steady decline. Just recently we jumped back up, so that's always good news. But, you know, ratings are, you know, I guess you can't put everything, you know, judge everything by what somebody,
sure,
how somebody else rates you. I think overall, obviously, I love riding in Wisconsin, and Wisconsin's a great place for cycling for a whole host of reasons. We're in the top three in miles of rail trails in Wisconsin in the nation. We have, you know, this wonderful network of really low traffic, scenic, paved country roads. Our town road system is mostly paved, whereas many other states it's gravel, so we can ride all day and only see like five cars on some of these, you know, rural communities. And and then we also are the center of Wisconsin cycling, or the nation's cycling industry. We have more bikes are built in Wisconsin than in all the rest of the states combined. We have, you know, Trek and Saris and Waterford Precision Cycle and Fixation and a whole host of others. So there's lots of reasons to be proud of Wisconsin and to enjoy riding in our state.
Let's talk about commuting a little bit. Is Wisconsin a good state, do you think, for people who want to bike to work, as a lot of people are doing in bike to work weeks around the state?
Sure. Well, you know, when you look at states, Wisconsin fares a little above average, I think, in percentage of people who ride their bike to work. In general, we've been following the national trend of having people riding their bikes for transportation has increased nationally at about 60%. Wisconsin's been up there. We have some cities that have far exceeded that. You know, Milwaukee, I think, biking to work is up 300%. Madison, it's up 200%. You know, so there's some, but most bicycling is local. So while I'm a proud, Badger, I ride my bike mostly in Milwaukee, and if somebody lives in Wausau, they ride their bike mostly in Wausau. So most bicycling is local, and I think we have to sort of look at commuting trends that way.
Well, let's go local a little. Are there communities that you think are making great strides in improving their bikeability, if I can make up that word?
Yeah, sure, you can make up any word you like. I'll roll with that. Yeah, you can. As I said, Milwaukee in the last decade or so has made serious investments. They started kind of from ground zero with very few amenities other than their trail system, and they quickly added a bunch of bike racks on buses, bike lanes, and that all resulted in a lot more people riding. So that's why Milwaukee saw such a massive growth in their journey to work data from the census. You know, like I said, about a 300% growth rate. Madison is also just a fabulous place to ride. It's probably our best community for cycling in the state, and it's rated as a gold bicycle-friendly community by the League of American Bicyclists, and I think anybody that visits there can quickly see why. There's a huge percentage of people that ride for transportation as well as recreation, and they have lots of great facilities from trails and innovative things like bike boxes and stuff like that. So Madison is obviously doing a lot of things right. But we don't have to look at just the big communities. Mm-hmm. We can look at the smaller ones. There's many smaller communities that are really doing all kinds of things to improve cycling. And nearby Milwaukee, I live on the west side in Wauwatosa, has just been making a lot of advances in cycling. They've been adding bike lanes. They've got plans for some green bike lanes and bike boxes in Wauwatosa on an important business strip that's gained a lot of businesses that get a lot of traffic from cycling. So, you know, you can look at La Crosse is doing great things. So the Fox Valley Appleton is doing a lot. They just installed their first bike corral, which is they replaced an on-street car parking spot with 10 bike parking spots. So there are lots of smaller communities that are doing great things.
Well, looking at communities even smaller than those you mentioned, say, you know, 2,000 to 5,000 people are in that ballpark, you know, not a huge budget. Are there cheap things they can do to, improve the bike culture, the bike ability of their areas?
Well, sure. There are some towns that, some communities that have been taking advantage of what they've already got and just promoting that more. One that I think of is the town of Sharon, where another community where they've got, you know, these great rural, paved rural roads with relatively low traffic volumes, and they make just for great riding just as they are. And so what they've done is they've taken some maps and put some lines on them, and now they're putting up some signs and identifying these preferred routes to promote, say, hey, come to town of Sharon and go on one of our bike rides that we've got signed, and we have maps to show you how to enjoy the great riding around our community. So there's something, you know, put up some signs, make some maps, and basically just promote what you've already got.
Now, mentioned that the League of American Bicyclists is the group that ranked Wisconsin number 3 in the country. They also just came out with a report on trying to break down the causes of bicycle fatalities around the country. They used 2012 data, the last year they had full data for. They found a lot of causes, sometimes car driver error, sometimes bike mistakes. But if you could wave a magic wand and change one thing to make bicycling safer here in Wisconsin, Dave, what would you like to see change?
Well, I guess the biggest thing would probably be that everybody obey all the rules of the road all the time. We just all get along much better when we all do that. So, and that means people that are riding bikes. Of course, we do a lot of education with teaching kids and adults around the state how to ride safely and legally. So that's bicyclists obeying all the rules of the road. Not kids not darting out of driveways, not riding on sidewalks where that's not appropriate, things like that. So we'd like, you know, everybody on a bike to obey all the rules of the road. Perhaps more importantly, just because, you know, the consequences are deadly when it doesn't happen. When people get behind the wheel of the car, we would like them not only to obey all the rules of the road, but to pay full attention to the act of driving. You know, our culture today, we're so busy and there's so many distractions from cell phones and you know, things like that, that it just seems like people are kind of phoning it in, so to speak, when they're behind the wheel. And when you're around people in crosswalks, people walking, places where there's bicycles, that's the time to pay full attention to the act of driving. So I think those are some of the things that could really help the most.
And the group that issued those reports we're talking about recommended Wisconsin create a vulnerable road user law to increase penalties for motorists who kill bicyclists or pedestrians. I know that was in the books, people were trying to pass that in Wisconsin. What's the status of that, and is that something you'd like to see here?
Well, we did, yeah. That's some legislation that we worked with a number of other groups, law enforcement officials and farmers and stuff, because all those people are considered vulnerable users of the road, too, to get passed last session. We did get kind of a watered-down version of it passed. So we'll have a vulnerable users, you know, law on the books. Unfortunately, the kind of the teeth were taken out of it at the last second in on the floor with an amendment, and the penalty enhancers were removed. So there's some additional education requirements and stuff with our vulnerable users law, but those penalty enhancers were removed. And you know, we're going to work to try to get those back in a, you know, a future legislative session. So we'll follow through on that. But the problem is that, and we heard this time and time again from both the family members of victims and from prosecutors, from district attorneys, that the way our laws currently sit, let's say you're driving along and through personal negligence, someone kills a person walking in a crosswalk because they were, at the time, they decided to look down and change the radio station, and they hit a little kid in a crosswalk. Well, the DA can't do anything. The two choices are homicide by negligent use, you know, of a vehicle, or a traffic ticket for failure to yield to a pedestrian. And the burden of proof for homicide is so high that what ends up happening is the driver that kills that little kid in the crosswalk ends up with nothing more than a traffic ticket of $150 to $650. And so what the vulnerable user bill was trying to do is create a graduated series of penalties in there that to try to remind people, as I said, that when you're around somebody, you know, a school or kids in crosswalks or people riding bikes, that's when you need to pay full attention. We were trying to put a graduated scale in there, and unfortunately those penalty enhancers were removed.
We're talking to Dave Schlabowski of the Wisconsin Bike Fed about making Wisconsin a better place to bike, a safer place to bike, and what makes it a good place to bike after a ranking put Wisconsin number 3 in the nation.
And we want to hear from you on this too. What do you think could make biking safer in Wisconsin? And as for the number 3 ranking we just got, what do you think makes Wisconsin so bike friendly? Where do you like to go biking in Wisconsin? What do you think about all the bike paths we have? What's your favorite one? Call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation about biking in Wisconsin now with Dave Schlabowski, Deputy Director for the Wisconsin Bike Federation.
This comes after a national ranking rated Wisconsin third best by a variety of criteria in bike friendliness in the country, and a study looking into bike safety, causes of bike accidents, and what to do about it. And we're taking your calls. What do you think makes Wisconsin a good place to bike? Is your community a bike-friendly area? What would you like to see change? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@wpr.org. Let's go right to our callers. We've got Kevin on the line in Green Bay. Kevin, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. Hey, great topic this afternoon. I think that the ranking is well-deserved. I think one of the great things about biking in Wisconsin is that we have so many trails in Wisconsin, you know, that are used for snowmobiles in the wintertime. And a lot of those trails, of course, are used for bicyclists in the summertime. And so I think if you're just looking for recreational opportunities, it's just endless, truly endless in what you can do in this state. And they're adding to them all the time. So I think that that's great. I think that urban biking is a little bit more of a tricky thing, though. I know that that it's tough for cities to commit dollars to you know, adding bike lanes and those kind of things. But I think that when they're redoing streets, they need to always consider this, especially main streets. I know that in Green Bay, we have a couple of main drags now that as they have improved them over the years, they have added the bike lanes, you know, to get in and out of the downtown area. And so I think that's important to continue that. But I also wanted to say a note on safety. I think that as bicyclists, we have to be our own best friends. I cannot believe how many people I see biking that do not wear an orange vest or a green vest or something to draw attention to themselves. Unlike motorcycles that have headlights that kind of flicker and flash, we can do that on a bicycle, but it doesn't make you nearly as visible. But if you're biking in daylight hours, you need to have something colorful that people can see you. And I can't believe how many people I see, kids and adults included, that aren't wearing helmets.
Kevin, we'll leave it there. Dave, a lot to talk about. Let's start with that last point first, making the case of wear those bright colors, wear those helmets when you're out on the bike.
Well, sure. You know, everybody can do a little bit more to make themselves more visible. That certainly doesn't hurt. I would just remind people that, you know, that bicycling in general remains an incredibly safe thing to do, no matter where you ride it in, or where you ride in the state of Wisconsin, whether that's in an urban area, a suburban area, or a rural area. It's still a really, really safe thing to do compared to a lot of other activities. And when you factor in the health benefits, it becomes an even better thing for people to do.
And he also mentioned when people are redoing roads to consider bikes. So it might be too expensive to change our existing roads all at once, but do you think as we're doing construction, country or city, we're taking bikes into account in how we rebuild our roads?
Certainly, and that's one of the reasons why Wisconsin rates highly by the League of American Bicyclists, because we do have a de facto complete streets law in our state legislature, which requires actually that when using state or federal funds on a project, that communities need to consider adding bicycling and walking facilities to those road projects, and that is the least expensive way to add those facilities when the project's already being reconstructed.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Callie now in Racine. Callie, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing? I got an issue with the bicycle problem in Racine. The drivers don't pay attention. You have the crosswalk. It's like they want to run you over. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I've ridden my bike in Florida, California, Alabama, New Orleans, everywhere, and it's like here, it's like it's not bike friendly. It's definitely not bike friendly.
All right, Callie, thanks for the call. So are there communities you think have room for improvement, Dave? I don't know if you want to single out Racine.
Certainly. There, and I do ride down to Racine from Milwaukee frequently. There certainly is room for improvement in attitudes and in sharing the road, and it varies by community. It tends to be better in places where more people ride, and I think that's because the people that are, when you're behind the wheel, you also have that same experience of when you're behind handlebars. So communities where more people ride bikes tend to have, I think, a little bit more bike-friendly attitude on the road. But certainly there could be more room for improvement, probably on both people's sides, whether you're riding a bike or behind the wheel.
Callie, thanks for the call. Be safe biking out there. We've got Paul on the line now in Madison. Hi, Paul.
Hi. You know, I think we just need more natural wells along the way because you, on a good Wisconsin day, you get so dehydrated. You know, maybe you're driving around on the trails with your puppy or in a little carriage, or, you know, maybe you're just out back and with your friends smoking some Kush, and, you know, you get cotton mouth and you just get all dehydrated, eh?
All right, Paul, we'll probably ignore that last bit there, but do we have enough amenities like water on bike trails?
Hey, I don't know if your listeners can tell by my accent, but I'm a Milwaukee guy, born and raised, grew up on the
south
side.
Bubblers.
Yep, I bring back the bubbler. I'm all for it.
All right, Dale in Watertown with us now. Dale, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I guess I got a couple questions. One of them is... out in our community, out in our area here, there's a lot of bicyclists, and it seems all of them seem to think the stop sign does not apply to them. That's one of them. And when a bicycle comes up to a street to cross, are they supposed to get off their bike, walk it across and be a pedestrian, or sit there on your bike like they're going to tear across on your bike? Are they a bicyclist or a pedestrian?
Hi, Matt. Dale, a couple of rules of the road questions for you, Dave.
Sure. Well, in general, bicycles are legally required to obey all the same rules of the road as motor vehicles. There are some exceptions. Bicycles are defined as legal vehicles on the road, so they're vehicles, not pedestrians. They are allowed, though, to use sidewalks. That varies by community. It's one of the few laws that the state makes that local communities can make up on their own. So in Milwaukee, it's illegal to ride on the sidewalk. If you're an adult, in some communities, it's not. So those things, the crosswalk question can vary, but in general, even where trails pass, past the road, a bicycle functions in the same in a crosswalk. If it's a trail crossing, and those are multi-use trails where the motor vehicle is required to yield the right of way to a bicycle or a pedestrian. It's the same, no difference in that situation with a crosswalk.
Dale's call, Dave, kind of reminds me a lot of times when you see an article out there about bike, car, pedestrian stuff, you end up with all the drama of the three-way shootout at the end of the good, the bad, and the ugly, where it's the pedestrians against the bikes and the cars and everybody mad at everybody else. Are we starting to mellow out and respect each other regardless of our mode of transportation a little more?
I think we're starting to see that. And again, I think it's because more people are doing more things. You know, I mean, 50% of people in Wisconsin ride bikes, and more of them are doing it for transportation, not just recreation. So when they get behind the wheel, they're more comfortable around people on bikes and that sort of thing. And we've worked really hard with the Department of Transportation. They've supported some of our education and encouragement events and programs around the state. So I think we are starting to see improvement. And I think it's also helpful to just remember that we all tend to break the rules, or a certain percentage of us tend to break the rules that get us from point A to point B faster. So, you know, I try to obey all the rules. I drive the speed limit. I'm not most people's friends on the freeway, but I drive the speed limit. You know, I stop for stop signs and red lights when I'm on my bike, but I also expect when I'm walking across the street in a crosswalk, for motor vehicles to yield the right of way to me. So I think, again, if we all obey all the rules of the road all the time, we'll all get along better.
And Dave, to wrap up, do you think biking is a high enough priority in the Wisconsin legislature?
Probably not. I don't think so. But I do believe that that they are facing some very serious financial troubles, and we are nationally. You know, the highway trust funds slated to go into deficit spending this August. So with all the potholes, we have everybody struggling to where's that extra money come from, because we had a hard winter. And so it's hard to allocate money. But the thing that I remind people is that you get so much for so little. Bicycling is a cheap date, and every dollar invested is returned many times over.
We'll leave it there. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Dave Schlabowski. He's deputy director for the Wisconsin Bike Fed. With all the cork sniffing and tasting terms like varietals and bouquet and more complicated stuff than that, the world of wine can be a little intimidating. So it might be hard to imagine actually making our own wine.
For today's Teach Me What You Know segment, we've got Alan Fitzgerald with us, who's been making his own wine for years. He's the president and winemaker at Fisher King Winery in Mount Horeb, and he's joining us now in studio to talk about how you can get started making your own wine. Alan, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, can you tell us how you first got started, got into making your own wine?
Well, I got an interest in winemaking very early on. Both of my parents are European, and, you know, my dad's Irish, my mom's German, and so we had wine as part of our family culture. I remember at age 4 sipping wine at the dinner table, and quite frankly, at age 4, not thinking very much of it, but but it was, you know, kind of lost some of its taboo or its, you know, secretive thing about, you know, having wine. And in fact, when I was in high school, I remember the encouragement of my mother. I was expressing an interest in, how do you make wine? What is that all about? She encouraged me to actually start exploring that and learning about it. So as early as high school, her only bit of advice to me back then was, well, just don't get carried away. And for the most part, I didn't, for the most part. But and then I, you know, I went off and got a biology degree and continued to make wine over all the years. I think I switched over to beer when I was in college, because you can make it a lot quicker than you can wine, and a little less expensively. So, but then when I got out of college and went on and got my business degree and all that, and started working in the real business world, I still continued to make wine all the time. And I took winemaking courses, got involved in the UC Davis certificate program and things like that. So I've been making wine forever and ever and ever and ever. And I finally got around to opening up my own commercial winery.
And when we think wine countries, we think, you know, Mediterranean, California, Chile, Australia, places with lots of warmth. And I know we've got lots of wineries here in the state, of course. What are some of the challenges, though, for hobbyists or the pros making wine in a winter state?
Well, you can make wine any time of the year. I mean, you do it indoors, so, mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like you have to be outside, you know, and the only time you're outside really is if you're growing grapes, your own grapes, or if you're bringing them in and you want to crush them outside, you know, but I don't have any friends named Lucy or Ethel anyway, so we don't kind of do it that old-fashioned way. We try to keep all the extraneous fungus out of the wine, much less, coming from crushing it around with your feet and everything. But, well, for winemakers, whether you are an amateur, you know, a home winemaker, or whether you're a commercial winemaker, the very, very best ingredients, the caviar of winemaking, is fresh fruit. And in this case, in most cases of wine, certainly not all of it, it's grapes, but also other fruits. You can make wine out of just about anything vegetative. In some cases, whether you can or you should are two different things. But in any event, there are some really lovely wines made not from grapes, mm-hmm. but from fruits and even vegetables. But you want, if you're doing grapes, you want the absolute ripest, exactly where you want them to be. You want them picked, and you want them right in your doorstep to be able to crush and press them and start turning them into wine. But for somebody getting started, or if you're in a place where you can't get a hold of grapes easily, and that only happens at harvest time typically in the fall, then you can start with concentrates and juices and things like that and start just practicing and playing around with that stuff.
Well, let's talk about getting started. Let's say you've got those perfectly ripe grapes, maybe some you grew on a small plot of your own land. What do you do next? How do you start?
Well, it's a big subject, even for, a home winemaker. Basically, you want to make sure that the grapes are ripened, that they are disease-free, that you've kind of kept track of them over the year. Maybe you sprayed them a little bit, hopefully with something relatively benign, but to keep some of the mold and other things off of them. And you've chased the birds away, and you've kept the Japanese beetles off of them, and you kept the rabbits from eating them and the deer. I got to tell you, grape growing is not for the faint of heart, especially if you want to do it on a little larger scale. Everything eats grapes or grape vines and leaves. If it isn't all the wide spectrum of molds and things like that, it's birds, it's rodents, it's bugs, it's many different things. So if you're actually, and then of course there's all the aspects of proper pruning and trellising and training, leaf pulling, canopy management, fertilizing, mowing, and being on a potential spray regimen a little bit. This is if you get particularly serious, if you like, are some of the vineyards, the commercial vineyards around the state. But you grow the grapes to a point where their ripeness is where they should be, the acidity level is where it should be, they're nice and clean and beautiful and sweet. And at that point, the winemaker, or the viticulturist in this case, decides now it's time to harvest, and you harvest the grapes, and you then, depending on whether it's a red or a white, you treat them a little differently, but either way, you're going to crush them first. And crushing involves beating them up, turning them into a slurry, basically removing the stems, the nice green stems, which you don't really want in there because they can impart green flavors, phenolic flavors in your wine, which are undesirable. So you get rid of the stems as gently and as thoroughly as you can. If you're a small winemaker, you can maybe do it by hand, or, you can also get a mechanical destemming crusher. But you crush them up, and that gives you a slurry of seeds and pulp and juice and skins, and that's called must. And if you're making a red wine, you pump that. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm so used to it now in a winery, pumping. If you're a home winemaker, you transfer that to a container to do primary fermentation, where you pitch the yeast on it. And if it's a white wine, I'm okay to keep talking.
Oh, yeah,
here,
but, yeah.
Okay.
Let's get the white.
And if it's a white wine, you're going to do the same thing. You're going to destem it and crush it and create that same must. But instead of immediately pumping it into a tank to start fermentation, you're actually going to put it through another process right before you do that, which is pressing. There's always crushing and there's always pressing. In almost all cases, not quite all, you have to always have those two. And so the pressing, rather than just beating it up and turning it into a mishmash, an oleo of all this stuff, it separates out, it squeezes out the juice from the solids. So with white wines, you're going to be putting that juice, that clear, sweet, beautiful, light white grape juice, into a tank and starting fermentation.
Well, I want to back up a little bit and get into gear here. And it sounds like I'd probably buy my fruit, first of all. But what's the basic starting kit if I want to experiment, dip my feet in, figuratively, not literally, to winemaking?
Well, the easiest thing to do, really, especially if you just want to get started, is to go to a local store, like right here in Madison, the Wine and Hop Shop. And actually, Dave Mitchell, who is the founder of the Wine and Hop Shop, also has Mitchell Vineyards. I'm just mentioning it down in Oregon. I'm sorry, Oregon, Wisconsin, not Oregon, the state. And he has a pick-your-own place. So in the fall, he has a lot of people coming out with their buckets, and they're picking the different grape varieties that they want, nice and fresh. He even has a little crusher and destemmer down there that he can take care of some of this stuff for you, and a press. So, but if you can't have access to grapes like that, you can go to any wine store, wine-making supply store, beer-making supply store, and you can find kits, or you can find them online. There's a whole wide range of mail-order places that have all these different kits available, and you basically buy the juice in concentrate form, and that's where you get the little kit in, and you take that juice, and you will put it into a carboy, and you will add yeast and put an airlock on it, and off you go. That's the basic. I mean, what makes wine is juice with flavorful compounds in it, sugar that's in the juice, and yeast. And the yeast, the whole process of fermentation, which is a biochemical process, can be quite complex, and there's many complex aspects to it. But in its simplest form, yeast takes the sugar from the grape juice and converts it into carbon dioxide, which just, in this case, you just dissipate. You don't use it for anything in a winery. And alcohol.
Right, and you got us to the point where we were we had our must or whatever it was into the vessel where it was going to be fermenting. So how long does it have to ferment? Yeah.
Well, that's going to vary a little bit. You know, I mean, I guess if you're a college student, you can probably be drinking wine in a month. But if you want good wine...
50 years later.
Yeah, well, maybe not 50, but, you know, primary fermentation, there's two parts to the fermentation when you first get the yeast pitched into the wine. It's a very, very active primary fermentation. It's very, very active. It's boiling in a way. You look at the wine and the must, and it's just churning away. It's throwing off lots of CO2. It's exothermic, so on a bigger tank, you have to watch out for the heat. The heat management is important. On smaller little 5-gallon carboys, it's not that big a deal when you're a home winemaker. After about 2 or 3 weeks of that, it settles down. It's, you know, it's done a lot of really rapid, vigorous fermentation, conversion of sugar into alcohol. And then it settles down into a much slower secondary fermentation, anaerobic fermentation, which does not throw off a lot of heat. And it can, you know, you're going to be doing that for a couple months of anaerobic fermentation. It depends, really. There's, like an economist, it depends. Mm-hmm. Depends on the grape and the yeast and what you're doing. And then if you finish up a wine around then, if it's a red, you might want to put it in oak to oak mature it, little oak barrels if you're a home winemaker.
What does the oak do?
Well, the oak does two things. It adds oak flavors to it. It gives more depth. Oak flavors leach out into the wine, and that for some reds, that can be desirable. It also adds a number of other compounds like tannins, which give wine the astringency, the sort of dryness to it. I look at the tannins as the equivalent in winemaking as hops are to beer a little bit, how they give it that dryness. And then the other thing is the oak barrels are breathable. You'll have air exchange and vapor exchange, and it actually oxidizes the wine. It matures it. It's called micro-oxidation, and it smooths out what might otherwise be an edgy wine. So the oak does those two things. It speeds up the aging process just enough so it makes the wine a little more nicer mouthfeel and drinkable, and it also adds those various compounds in, which for some reds can be a big enhancement.
Alan, what was it like? You were, I think you said, in high school when you made your first wine, when you had your first successful batch and tried it. What was it like?
Well, it was great, especially when you're in high school. At the very beginning, my standards weren't very high, and it's like we were drinking almost anything that I would make. You know, I'm sorry. That was then and this is now. No, of course, it was very gratifying. But the learning process, even now, I have quite a bit more experience in winemaking, and I'm always learning new things, and there's always times I get faced with new challenges. You can get into this as deep as you want or as superficially as you want, but it all starts with that first batch of wine or first 2 or 3 batches and reading some good winemaking books and maybe talking to some winemakers. And then there's also the Wisconsin Vintners Association, which is a large group of people who've all gotten together and have created the non-commercial, basically amateur winemakers group. And that's a very good group to be in touch with if you just want to start out making wine.
Alan, thank you so much for joining us. You've given us a lot to work with here, obviously a lot to learn, but we've got a little bit of a handle on it there. Yeah, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Alan Fitzgerald, the president and winemaker at Fisher King Winery in Mount Horeb.